Thanks very much indeed, and it's a real pleasure to be here. I have prepared just brief remarks. I think this will be a most productive setting, if session, if we have a chance to entertain your questions and to pursue those issues which are of the most interest to yourselves. Let me just set the scene with some preliminary observations. It has now been almost 5 years since the climactic moments of the financial crisis that began to unfold in August of 2007 and that culminated near panic of September and October of 2008 in the United States, and that led shortly afterwards to the opening developments in what has become the crisis of the European Union and especially of the Eurozone. 5 years is quite a long time, and if you go back to the to that period and ask what in early 2009 or mid-2009 was the common expectation for 2013, I think you would find that the official predictions were that the crisis would be over. And that mentality is very much part of the problem that we face. The fact is, of course, that the crisis is not over, that expectations that there would be a bottom, a turnaround, and a recovery have been repeatedly disappointed, but that we are faced from practically every official organization with an unending series of forecasts which simply say that in a little while, the recovery will begin again. And that the only thing that is necessary to do is to stick with the present course of policy that these developments will unfold. It's clearly necessary after a certain amount of time to ask the most penetrating questions about that frame of mind and that point of view. It's also, I think, remarkable, and I spoke on this in more detail yesterday, but I think it's quite remarkable that in the 5 years since the these very dramatic events, there has been very little by way of intellectual development, that is to say, of efforts to reassess and reanalyze the economic understandings that have led not only to the crisis itself, but also to this pattern of expectations that things will return to a previously normal condition over a certain amount of time. I think the difficulty is now increasingly plain to people who are not economists, but who are motivated by simple common sense, which is that we have entered a period of very profound structural difficulties, and a period in which our economic policy debate is locked in an intense struggle between two inadequate positions, one of them actually in power and catastrophic, the other one much better in its intentions, completely without political influence, but also in its own way unable to see the true depth of the situation that we face. The position in power, obviously, are those who have called for and implemented the politics of austerity, the politics of cutting, the politics of the reduction of social welfare programs, the politics of cutting wages. This is a position which is motivated, I think, by two principal arguments. One is that you need to cut back on the public sector both its expenditures and to raise its taxes in order to be able to service previously existing public debt owed primarily, substantially outside the country, or I should say, especially outside the country. And that is, a cut-to-pay position, which is a position, obviously, of great interest to the financial interests who hold those debts. And the second position is one which it has the idea in it that the cuts are needed in order to restore a competitiveness in the larger world economy, a position that cuts are needed in order to be able to maintain the position of the country or of the continent in a world in which you have an increasingly important presence of countries such as China. I know that noted yesterday at the Banca Popular that Signor Bertinotti pointed out to me that Signor Draghi had argued that the European social welfare systems could not survive in a world in which they had to compete with the Chinese. And my thought on that was that it was an extremely dangerous matter when the head of a central bank had so little faith in the capitalist system that he was prepared to surrender its core institutions in the face of a threat from a country which is still being run by its Communist Party. And so particularly here, I want to point out to you that this is an issue worth raising and pursuing. The fact is, neither of these positions stands to reason or logic. The proposition that one has to cut back on core institutions in order to pay debts overlooks the fact that the cuts themselves are destroying the economic foundation of economic activity in the peripheral countries of Europe, that the reduction of economic activity, minus 30% over 5 years, for example, in Greece alone, 2 years of ongoing recession here in Italy, reduces the tax base and makes the debt burden continue to rise. And so long as the interest rate on the debt exceeds the growth rate of the economy, it is practically impossible. In fact, it is impossible as a practical matter to cut public budgets by enough to reverse the financial position of the country. Another solution will have to be found on that front, and I will come back to it. And again, on the other side, the notion that there is any ability to compete with the emerging countries of Asia on their own terms, I think is fundamentally illusory. China is an extremely big country. India is another very big country. China, in particular, will decide to do what it wants to do. And it cannot be dissuaded from that. And the proposition in the rest of the world that we have to face is that we have to think of things for ourselves to do that the Chinese are not doing or that are complementary or that enhance our living standards and improve our ability to function as organized and civilized societies. And we can do that. And there is absolutely no reason that China does not stand in the way of a sensible reorganization of the world economy in which in which they have a place. So the notion that we should engage in a race to the bottom with countries that are emerging into world markets is a preposterous notion, and a notion which is can only lead to the destruction of the societies in which we exist. Okay, so the austerity position is one which is intellectually incoherent, and which has led to enormous damage, ongoing damage, in Europe and increasingly also in the United States, although for reasons I will come to, the U.S. has been somewhat less subjected to this particular line of policy than the southern tier of the European Union has been. The alternative position, the primary alternative position, simply holds that what is needed is to reverse the austerity policies and to have a set of programs which go by the name of stimulus in order to restore economic growth to its long-term track. And while I think this set of policies and ideas has certainly something to recommend it, it is better to for the public sector to be active than inactive in this situation, we should also recognize that even if these policies were adopted with with enthusiasm, which is extremely unlikely to occur, there would still be profound difficulties in the face of a full return to the kind of economic expansion of which we became accustomed over the previous half century since the Second World War. The reality, it seems to me, is that when we look back on this period in a few years, and with clarity of view, in fact, we can look back on it now, we will understand that around 2000, we reached the end of an era, the end of a particular model of economic growth, and that the crisis that hit in 2007 was the culmination of efforts to forestall realization and acknowledgement of that fact. And further, I think we will find when we think about this that the crisis of 2007, 2008, 2009, and onward was not a set of isolated events in the United States and in Greece and in Spain and in Portugal and in Ireland and in Italy, but a single unified event affecting the global financial system that was precipitated by developments in the United States, but that in fact had consequences that involved precipitating the credit crisis of the European periphery. Okay, what are the reasons why I think the economic conditions facing us today are fundamentally more difficult than they were in the previous period? I think there are basically three of them. First is energy, the cost of resources, which reached a turning point essentially at the turn of the millennium. And we now live in a world where it is extremely difficult to have growth without having a rapid increase in the prices of raw materials, price of commodities, price especially of primary energy products. These markets have become heavily financialized, dominated by speculators, with the effect that when we have a little bit of economic expansion, the fruits of that expansion get taxed away very quickly in higher energy prices. And we've already seen this, I think, happen once in the period since the great financial crisis, but it was also a precipitating factor for that crisis in 2008 when the price of oil reached $148 very briefly just before the end. This was a fact that was not noticed all that much in the general excitement of the period, but it is something which is, I think, of very considerable importance. Second factor is technology and the consequences of the digital revolution through which we're all living, which was perhaps not so serious in a long period of economic expansion. But when there is a crisis and businesses find that they have to lay off workers and do so, they then discover in the aftermath that the technologies permit them to operate much more cheaply without hiring those workers back and without expanding their labor forces. And I think there's really no need to dwell on this. It's, I think, a very central part of all of our existence to recognize that a great part of our working population had been engaged in one way or another in the processing of information, and that much of that work will not be recreated in the private sector, which raises the question for all of us as to how we have institutions which permit people to have jobs, give people jobs, useful things to do, productive things to do, interesting things to do, but without relying on, let's say, the services sector to reabsorb those workers when an expansion happens, because simply they aren't likely to do it. And the third big area, and perhaps the most important one, is finance. We have been relying for about 30 years in the United States and in Europe on credit expansions to bring about growth in underlying economic activity. And in the United States, we had a moment of rather considerable success in this area in the late 1990s as a result of the fact that we were the location of the information technology boom, which culminated in the spring of 2000. And that gave us big increase in total investment and a big increase in total employment in a period when the unemployment rate was under 4% for about four consecutive years. In Europe, the primary beneficiaries of financial expansion, particularly after 2000, were governments, in the case of Greece, who expanded to fund, among other things, the Olympics, and commercial and residential real estate in places like Ireland and Spain. And in the United States, after the business boom ended in 2000, there was an ongoing growth of lending in the mortgage sector, which was of an increasingly corrupt character. And in fact, had by the middle of that decade become suffused, infested with financial fraud to a very profound degree. That is to say, the mortgages were extended to millions of people who it was known from the beginning would never pay those debts, that they would be able to pay them for a few years at most, and then they would either have to refinance them, generating another set of fees, or they would default. And the mortgage instruments were then packaged. They were submitted to the ratings agencies under terms which allowed the ratings agencies to give them very high ratings, as you all know, and sold off to investors who would take eventually a very serious loss. And many of those investors were here in Europe, which meant that when the mortgage crisis hit the United States banking system, it would not be long before European investor communities recognized that they too were going to suffer great losses. And that is a major factor in the opening up of the European crisis. Which is to say, in Europe, when investors found they were going to take losses on the US assets they had bought, they sold off the weaker credits that they had in European sovereign debt and bought the stronger ones. And they had this divergence of interest rates from between the Greece and Spain and so forth, and Germany, Britain, and the United States on the other hand. Two things about the financial sector going forward. One is that this process is unlikely to be repeated anytime soon. That is to say, it's very unlikely that there will be a finance-driven economic expansion in either the United States or Europe. In the United States, the household sector is simply broke. It is deleveraging, it is paying off its debts or defaulting on them, and it is not going to be the source of a major new credit expansion. The company sector will not be the source of a major new expansion if the household sector is not expanding. So that's that. And in Europe, the situation is obviously well known to you, that the entire pressure of the creditor community is on retrenchment and deflation rather than on any possibility of expansion. So that's point number one. The finance sector is not there to fuel a new economic expansion. And secondly, unfortunately, even though the finance sector is not doing its work, it still exists. And you have an enormous dead weight on the economy, which is the cost, the fixed cost imposed by very large financial institutions that absorb real economic resources, have very high payrolls, especially at the top, but in fact serve no public or social economic function. And the result of that is that they are in charge on the profits of every other kind of business, including the kind of businesses that employ ordinary workers. So you have a situation in which, in the United States, 10% of wages are paid to workers in the financial, people in the financial sector. That is far too much. And it's that comes out of the interest payments made by every other kind of business and restricts their profitability and their ability to expand. So the financial sector stands as a very major obstacle to recovery. And I suggest that this picture stands in very substantial contrast to the standard one, which has been promulgated by, for example, the Austerity Party, which holds that one has to satisfy the demands of the financial sector in order to restore its confidence, in order that it will begin lending again. It's, I think, clear from this picture that the restoration of confidence is a completely illusory goal. Even the best behavior on the part of the most of an indebted country is not going to bring back confidence for the simple reason that the markets will retreat from all of the vulnerable regions if any one of them suffers a setback or if there's any adverse news anywhere else. So even the most religious dedication to the principles of austerity is not going to bring Portugal back into a position of being a site of major new financial expansion. It's just not going to happen. Now, I want to just touch briefly on the European situation as distinct from that in the United States. Because it is the case that the situation in the United States, though unhappy, relatively stagnant, is also relatively stable. And the reasons for that, I think, have to do with the fact that in the U.S., a large federal government grew very rapidly in the crisis, greatly effectively replacing much of the income that was lost by unemployment, for example, through unemployment insurance, disability payments, food stamps, tax reductions. And then on top of that, the package of measures, expansion measures, stimulus measures that the Congress enacted. And secondly, because in the United States, the debts that are in question are principally household debts. And over time, households pay their debts or default on them. In either case, the debts go away. In Europe, the structure of the European Union is not that of a federation. It is rather that of a confederacy. And a confederacy, a form of government that we have had in North America one or two times in the past, unsuccessfully, is an extremely weak and unsuccessful form of economic governance. It permits the formation of a creditor's cartel in part of the region to the detriment of the debtors in the other part of the region. It permits a biased implementation of automatic stabilizers so that the big countries can run big deficits internally and keep their societies on a reasonably even keel, while the indebted countries, and especially the smaller indebted countries, cannot do this and are forced into constant retrenchments which basically push their social institutions, their education, their healthcare, and so forth to the breaking point. So that's a problem of the structure of the European Union. And then there is the second issue, which I'm sure you're all very aware of, which is the political mismatch, which is to say that the leadership that has the most influence in the European Union's decisions is not responsible to voters from the indebted regions. The Greeks and the Italians do not vote in Germany, permitting the governments of the most influential countries to adopt an ethic of punishment and to get away with it because those being punished are not their own voters, which again is not the situation in the United States. And that being so, one has a very complex and intractable both institutional and political situation. And I'm sure, again, that you are as well aware or more aware of this than I could possibly be. What is needed? I think it is possible to spell out in hypothetical terms a program of action that would, in principle, at least stabilize the situation. I do not believe it is reasonable or realistic to base a program of action on the expectation that we can return to the growth rates and the of the previous half century. I just don't think it's a reasonable thing to do. If we had good luck and we did better than expected, that would be fine. But holding it out as an expectation or a promise is a formula for disappointing the people who are receiving that promise. The job should be one, first and foremost, of stabilizing things, of trying to make sure that our societies hold together and move forward in a way which is compatible with basic human decency. What's required? First thing is a bonfire of the debts. That's the phrase Keynes used in 1919 with respect to the Treaty of Versailles. A bonfire, a general bonfire of the debts. Now, a bonfire of the debts can be accomplished under the terms of the European Charter by mutualizing them. That's the modest proposal of my friend Yanis Varoufakis and my friend Stuart Holland. And the idea is that you take all of the first 60% of GDP of the public debts of all of the Eurozone countries, and you put them in a common pool, and they share a common interest rate. And that makes it put the interest rate down on those debts, and then the debts that are above that threshold will also be much more sound than they were if they're all being paid at the interest rates that apply to the specific nation states. I think that's a very important central proposal, and one which deserved to be pressed much harder than it has been. Second thing is you need to restructure the banking sector, something that we also absolutely need to do in the United States, to make it smaller, to make it responsible, if possible, to an effective regulating authority, and to give it back some public function. And if that means creating new institutions of the kind that were present in Europe in the post-war period, so that you have investment banks and development banks and employment banks and so forth, well, then that should also be done, right? Because banks are not forever, and they are not institutions that should be allowed to run countries. It should be the other way around. They should be, finance should serve a larger public purpose. That is why banks have to have charters. Third thing is you need an investment program and a jobs program that has funded through the European institutions, through the European Investment Bank, which is capable of doing a fair amount along these lines. And that should be aimed at trying to create new poles of economic activity, especially in the peripheral countries, institutions in particular that can provide employment on a sustained basis. That's the three elements of what Varoufakis and Holland call the modest proposal. I think it's a very sensible approach which lies entirely within the framework of existing European treaties. It doesn't require renegotiation. I would add to that, and I think in a next version of this proposal, we will add to it an element which I would draw from the experience of the United States, and that is the element of social insurance and social stabilization. Now, obviously, social insurance programs have existed inside each European country, but the point of the New Deal in the U.S. was to extend what had existed inside individual American states to the entire country, a continental enterprise where it had never previously existed. And what were the elements of that? Deposit insurance for banks, right? Financial institutions. A very important measure, and unfortunately, of course, deposit insurance is not credible if it's the national responsibility of a small country like Cyprus, and not adequate if it's, in present levels, 100,000 euro, or in the US before the crisis, $100,000. We raised that limit to $250,000 in the height of the crisis in September, October of 2008, and that prevented a run on the banking system, something which is an increasingly imminent threat in certain European contexts. I would go beyond that form of insurance to have a common pool to help equalize and stabilize pensions, right, across the European periphery, stabilizing the incomes of the elderly in the European periphery. This is the equivalent of Social Security in the United States. Its function is to provide a stable future for people who are working now, but also to provide a stabilization of total effective demand so that you do not have a collapse of incomes. Right? And what's happening in Greece, for example, is the incomes of the retired have been cut dramatically. Unemployment insurance. I know the German trade unions have endorsed the idea that unemployment insurance be extended to the European community as a whole by Europe, so that some of the cost of the crisis, which is presently being borne by the unemployed, can be borne by the European community in common. I think minimum wages and topping up schemes, the equivalent of the earned income tax credit, could be added to that eventually. But I think what needs to be emphasized here is that the core of the program is a program of social solidarity and stabilization, something which ought to be a principle of European Union, and which is in any event indispensable, as I say, not just for human purposes, not just for purpose of compassion and decency, but for the stabilization of economic activity. So that's what I would suggest could be the elements of a core set of changes, and in the current structure of European policy. And I say the chances of this happening are not high. In fact, they're very low. But that's not really the issue. The point for us who realize the gravity of the situation is to have a program that one can begin to advance and begin to express the case for, so that it will not be said that there is no alternative to the austerity policy or no alternative to the very shallow program of let's just spend a little money through a stimulus program and everything will be fine, when we know that's not the case. How does one get there? Well, the answer to that is you get there by negotiation, a topic on which I trust I do not need to instruct a trade union. And there is a great principle of negotiation, which is you negotiate from strength. You do not negotiate from fear. So one has to be willing to assert with great confidence and assurance the correctness of one's position. One has to be willing to accept the risk that the negotiation will fail, and be aware that there are consequences of that. The consequences in the case of a breakup of the European Union would be, I think, very disruptive and very grave. Not necessarily non-survivable, not necessarily something that couldn't be dealt with in the long run, but something that it would be much better to avoid if by making the negotiations succeed. One should anticipate and publicize what the other side will do when faced with a determined negotiation, because there will be provocations and disruptions that can be turned against this position. And those disruptions and provocations may run through the financial system. We've seen an example of what can happen in the recent experience of Cyprus. So I think one needs to be aware of these things, but nevertheless determined. And I'll just close on that line by noting that some years ago, in fact, in January of 1961, my father, who, as you know, was also an economist, was in a position to give some advice to President-elect John F. Kennedy about what he should say in his inauguration speech on the 20th of January, 1961. And my father basically got one line into that speech. And it's a line I'll leave you with. It's a line he was very proud of for the rest of his life. And Kennedy said this. He said, "We must never negotiate from fear, but we must never fear to negotiate." Thank you very much.